Hello, folks. Welcome to another edition of the World Labor Hour on Corporate Free Community Radio Station WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. Views and opinions expressed here are those of speakers and do not necessarily represent the views of WRFU, the Urbana-Champaign Independent Media Center, or the Urbana Socialist Forum. WRFU, Radio Free Urbana, community radio by and for the people, broadcasting at 104.5 FM and webcasting live worldwide at WRFU.net. This hour program is brought to you by the Central Illinois Jobs and Justice Coalition of Community and Union Groups working for economic justice and workers' rights. Central Illinois Jobs with Justice holds regular meetings on the third Saturday of every month at 9:30 a.m. at the Channing Murray Foundation, 1209 West Oregon in Urbana. For more information, go to centralillinoisjwj.org. The Graduate Employees Union, the GEO at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, strives to not only democratically represent graduate employees, but to also give solidarity and support to unions, organizations, and workers engaged in a struggle for social justice both on and off campus. The GEO is proud to support the World Labor Hour. The World Labor Hour is also supported by Decatur attorney William Faber, who believes that the mission of the law is the safety of the people. Bill Faber proudly supports the World Labor Hour. This hour program is also supported by the AFL-CIO Champaign County. The AFL-CIO represents the interests of over 7,000 workers in Champaign County and over 13 million workers nationwide. Recognizing that strong workers build strong communities, the AFL-CIO is proud to support the World Labor Hour and community radio in East Central Illinois. The Campus Faculty Association at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign advocates for academic freedom, shared governance, and a strong faculty voice on campus. The CFA is proud to support community radio and the World Labor Hour in support of strong unions. You can learn more about the CFA by visiting CFAIllinois.org. And last but not least, the Illinois Singer Payer Coalition is proud to sponsor the World Labor Hour on WRFU-FM. The Illinois Single Payer Coalition believes that health care is a human right and is dedicated to expand and improved Medicare for all. For more information, go to ilsinglepayer.org. Okay, just to let you know, we're going to have several special guests today. First of all, I got here live in the studio Marv Tell Miller and Chris Evans, who are going to be discussing the upcoming Champaign quarter cent sales tax ballot referendum that many people are calling a jail tax. And then shortly after 12 noon, we're going to be having Illinois Green Party U.S. Senate candidate Scott Summers to call in and discuss his campaign and why the Green Party is the only nationwide opposition political party currently in the U.S. that opposes corporate control of our government. So we'll just get right to it. Martel, Chris, welcome to the World Labor Hour.
Thanks for having us, and it's an honor to be on this program.
Thanks for having us again on your show, Dave.
Okay.
Especially me.
Okay. Now, just to start things off here, you guys have a program on WRFU as well, don't you?
We haven't been doing it in the last probably, I'd say, 2-3 months.
Oh, okay.
I'm working on trying to move it to a live television show. I've been having a discussion with Brian Dolliver, talking to Chris how we're going to get this done. I want to get it up and running probably by January.
Okay. All right. So I guess the main reason here is I don't want to limit it to the jail tax or the quarter cent referendum. I think there's a lot of background to this that needs to be discussed in general. So if you want, we can start with some background, or we could just go right to the sales tax referendum and then kind of work backwards, whichever you guys prefer.
Well, we can do that. The voters should know, Tuesday is election day, and the Champaign County government has placed on the ballot a question asking the voters whether or not they would like to be taxed an extra quarter cent sales tax, which would be a quarter cent for every dollar of retail sales in the county, to pay for what is called facilities. And it's very important to note that the referendum on the ballot will say only to pay for facilities that the county operates and maintains. But the problem with that, Martel, is what?
They're saying it's for facilities, but they're giving the money to the sheriff and not giving him a really direct way where he had to spend the money. And the county has been trying to get a jail for about the last 5 years, and citizens have stopped it. And they just didn't figure out a way how to go around the citizen and raise the money.
Yeah, basically what the county has done is put together a package of buildings that they want to work on. And one of the first and foremost priorities that the county has established is the expansion to the satellite jail for to the tune of $18 million, and that includes a $3 million sheriff's office. And so the first priority they want to do with this this quarter-cent sales tax, which will raise $50 million over 12 years if it's passed, and the first $18 million is going to go toward expanding the county satellite jail. We should say that there's two jails in Champaign County. There's one in downtown Urbana that holds about 50 people, and then the satellite jail holds about 182 people, and the county wants to build 100 beds out at the satellite jail, and that would include a 30-unit medical facility. So they're packaging this as a more humanitarian way to house inmates, and that they will be able to provide medical care better, both mental health and physical care at the county jail, if they were to pass this tax and be able to build this medical unit on this facility. However, they have no plan to staff or, no doctors or nurses are going to be paid for with this jail tax.
So basically it's just going to be some new sales that are labeled quote-unquote medical jails, and you're still going to have the same deputies that are untrained in detox, mental health, or any of the other needed skills.
That's right. And what's really sick is that probably what they don't tell you what the medical unit will be comprised of, but what is currently, and we had a harrowing testimony from Charles Davidson at the last forum that we held at the Champaign Public Library, who was a former inmate going through with heroin withdrawal in the county jail. And what they do for medical treatment in that situation is stripped him all of his clothing and threw him in a single cell with no blanket, no nothing, and just all this air conditioning, and where he had to, for 3 days, sleep on concrete while he went through the experience of heroin withdrawal, and he almost died in the county jail. So the jail is no place to get medical treatment, but the quarter cent sales tax is being packaged as a way to be more humanitarian toward inmates. But we feel that Build Programs Not Jails, which is an organization that's been fighting the jail expansion for the last 4 years, we feel that the investment of the county dollar should be toward keeping people out of jail.
Yeah, and I agree with everything that Chris says, but with me, when they're talking about this county jail, there's certain things I think this sales tax could be used for. And one would be early child learning. If they would put someone there for early child learning. And then they talk about the nursing home, the problems of the nursing home. The nursing home is not getting paid by the state. We need to really examine what we need to do for our nursing home, because by the next probably 10 years, we won't have more senior citizens than we never had in the United States. Instead of us looking at a jail, we got to look at how we can keep this county nursing home, because its holds are like 150 medical beds for, like, if you have, like, if you don't have all the insurance and you have Medicaid or Medicare, that them the beds, they got like 150 beds there, and they got the most beds in the county. And I think that's what if we're going to do a sales tax, I would support something like that. But I cannot support one for a jail.
Yeah, now aren't they kind of holding the nursing home hostage on this?
Exactly. They've packaged the nursing home in with this whole facilities package to say, if you don't vote for the quarter cent sales tax, then we might have to close or sell the nursing home, which is ludicrous to build a jail that way. You know, and the number one priority of this quarter cent sales tax is to fund jail expansion, and the nursing home was just thrown in to make it more attractive to the taxpayers.
Okay, now Martell, you said earlier that they've been trying to do this for 5 years now.
A little over 5 years.
Yeah.
Well, actually, the sheriff has been doing this since 2002, since he came on board. He has been floating the idea and pressuring the county board to consolidate all the jailing down at the satellite. They want to close the downtown Urbana jail and do move all the jailing out at the satellite. He's been at this since 2002. He really made his move in 2011. So Martell's right. It's been about 4 years that they've really been after it. But he's been at it since 2002.
And when we're looking at our jails in Champaign, we got a jail that's built in 1992. We have one built, that other one was built in 1985, right?
No, that's, I think, sometime in the late 70s, because I worked on that a short time when I was an apprentice.
That was the old jail. They knocked down the old jail.
Oh, the old jail, the one that was used to be the house.
Yeah. That, and we got that jail in 1985. And I remember probably 4 years ago when they first started talking about the jail. And we looked at some research. Most of the jails in Illinois is like 75 years old. And they said our jail is obsolete.
Yeah, that's what's amazing. And like I said, I worked on that jail downtown Champaign for a short time as an apprentice. And I mean, that building is sound. I mean, it's poured concrete, brick, and, you know, they keep saying it's falling apart. And when you finally get specifics on it, you find out what's quote unquote falling apart is they haven't maintained the roof. They haven't maintained, lighting fixtures and other electrical things. And also, I've heard that they have a problem with insects and some rodents, you know. I mean, this is just sort of general maintenance stuff that they should have been doing all along. That's not any definition of, you know, construction as falling apart.
Well, the National Institute of Corrections inspected the county jail in 2011 and came up with described the county, the downtown Urbana jail as deplorable for the following reasons: peeling paint,
okay,
insects, and dingy lighting.
Okay.
Do you? I don't know, Dave. You've been in the trades, you know, longer than anybody. Do you knock a building down for those reasons?
Not usually.
Yeah.
And then you got a steel frame building.
Yeah.
And if you got a steel frame building, you can change a whole lot. It'd be definitely was built out of wood. But a steel frame, you can actually have an architect come there and re-architect that building if you need to.
Yes, indeed. In the satellite jail, I mean, that was primarily built with precast concrete, which I know I went to one of the county board hearings when they had that architect, jail architect, Kimmy, I think his name is,
right.
Try to sell this as like a Cadillac, you know, a superior product, you know, when precast concrete is a Pinto at best. For those too young out there, Pintos were a cheap car made by Ford in the mid-late 70s. It tended to explode when they were rear-ended, you know. It's just ridiculous. I mean, you know, the county is going to, you know, pay a lot of money for that satellite jail, and it's not a very well-built building.
Yeah, the county has had to there is scheduled in their list of deferred maintenance is $3 million more dollars of deferred maintenance on just the satellite jail, just to bring up the old part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then they're going to add the 100 beds, and that's the rest of that money.
And when you say old part of it in the satellite, I mean, I can't remember. Was that the one built in 1992? Okay. That's – are you kidding me? I mean, that's just, you know – that's only 15 years?
Right.
Oh, I'm sorry, 1992 is a little over 20 years.
But if you look at the move across the rest of the United States, everybody's trying to decarcerate. Our state is trying to decarcerate. The Fed's trying to decarcerate. And now we're building a jail to incarcerate. So I think we're going a little backwards in this county.
Yeah, so that'd be 50 extra jail cells. I mean, from what you were telling me, doing the math quickly in my head here. You know,
Build Programs, Not Jails, keeps a daily count of the jail population, and we've been counting it at about 180. The satellite jail in total holds 182.
Okay.
And they're housing 50 other people in the downtown jail right now. So, right, I mean, but the total number of inmates is about 180 people. So
and
they don't.
Let me interrupt you, Chris. When we talk about inmates, are these people dangerous and they should not be on the street? Or what is the reason these people are being here?
Nobody knows because nobody keeps track of it. It's listed, but it's never been tabulated. And what the
so we got that many violent criminals? We got 180 violent criminals every day that should be locked up.
Apparently,
you know, I heard that Champaign County. I mean, I think this is kind of not untypical, but you know, definitely in Champaign County, I heard a vast majority of the people in the county jail are there because they can't afford bail, or they're there for small drug possession charges and other minor stuff.
Right. They're not violent crimes, right?
No. Well, there was a class at the University of Illinois that was studied. They tracked 5,016 police contacts with citizens and found that 92% of them were for nonviolent reasons. And so what Martell's alluding to is that most of the people in the county jail are in for nonviolent crimes, mm-hmm. and that's thefts, driving on a suspended license, ordinance violations. What people don't realize is that both City of Urbana and City of Champaign are using the county jail to extract fines and fees from defendants who don't pay within a 60-day period. And if they don't pay within 60 days, they get a bench warrant issued out for their arrest. And so every day, the police are taking people into jail for ordinance violations, which are the small, petty crimes that aren't even state charges, that are city charges. And you get a ticket for that offense, and it's supposed to be a non-jailable offense unless you're held in contempt of court for not paying within 60 days.
This almost sounds like debtor's prison.
It's exactly what it is, and so what Bill Programs Not Jails has recommended, as well as the Community Justice Task Force that the county formed in 2012 has recommended to the county is that they get some pretrial services so that they can gauge on a more scientific and more objective level as to why people are, whether or not they are a risk to flee the county or be a danger in the community, and let people go that can't afford, just because they can't pay bond, they should be allowed, they're still innocent until proven guilty, so they should be allowed to wait for trial outside in the community. The vast majority of those in the county jail are waiting trial. They're not even found guilty yet. And so the recommendation is that we figure out who can wait on the outside instead of chewing up tax dollars being in the jail.
I'm going to switch up on some, Chris. When we're talking about our county jail, we got a racial justice task force, which they should be able to let them complete what they're doing before they even put a jail on the map, because we got such a racist bias in our county on police stops, arrests, drug arrests, and stuff like that. And these some things, and traffic stops. We got a banner looking at traffic stops, in which they're trying to get out of getting another guy to come look at the numbers on the traffic stop, in which we know for years, at least I know for years, because me and Patrick started our mentor and tutoring program, the first thing we found out with the young folks, young teenagers, they said they had a problem with the police. And when we went and talked to them, we tried to say they was in the wrong place doing the wrong things. Well, we was telling them they were all wrong. They were actually getting stopped, searched, and the rights being violated. And we got that on the table in the banner, racial task force for traffic. Then we got a racial justice task force for the county. And I think both of them ought to be done before we even talk about building a county jail.
I heard something to the effect that Champaign County has the worst racial disparity as far as people in the county jail system.
And that was on the last show I was on when I think James said that.
Uh-huh.
He said the percentage is so high at like 70%, and we only like 13-14% of the county. Is something really wrong with that?
I would say so.
67% of the people sent to the penitentiary from Champaign County are African American.
67%, and the African American population in Champaign County is 13%. Wow.
Yeah, it's worse than Ferguson, Missouri. And it's probably one of the worst in the country. So Martell's correct that the Racial Justice Task Force should be allowed to do its work before we talk about building a jail. But we shouldn't be talking about a jail at all. We should be talking about the sheriff estimates that 40% of those in the county jail have either a mental illness or a substance abuse problem.
And that's from the sheriff himself.
That's from the sheriff himself. Yeah. So the question is, how would you want medical treatment for substance abuse and mental illness to be done? Do you want to be done in a county jail, or could we do that out in the community?
So sick people should go to the jail to get services. Still have a facility built for sick people.
Right.
Yeah. So basically, for understanding, Bill Programs Not Jails is advocating, one, to fully support the nursing home, and two, to actually build a separate community-based detox and mental health center in the community.
Correct. I think that would be the best bet, because I just can imagine trying to get someone to go for a substance abuse problem at the county jail.
Yeah.
Mental illness, and because it could change. Just to put them in that location of law enforcement, if they would do them like, an officer come out there and say something, they can get charged with resisting arrest, or if they take off running, they get off charged with fleeing and eluding the officer, because you didn't put them in a situation where they come directly in contact with law enforcement, where
yes.
instead of the person's heart takes effect and say, you know, maybe let him run and maybe he'll come back, but the law enforcement say, he's here now, we got to keep him, and we do all these things. He can go from trying to get services to being arrested and into a court action.
Yeah, that seems like that's an easy scenario to imagine.
Well, law enforcement is not trained to do mental health, and is not trained to do medical care. And that's what's contributed to the 3 deaths in the last year at the county jail, because
the total ones all yes. in the last
They're
8
over,
years.
Over 12.
In the last 8 years.
12 people that have died.
12 people in 8 years, 3 just in the last year.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Paul Clifton was one. I went to middle school with him. He's a friend. He was a friend of your cousin.
No. Paul Clifton, his son is like a son to me, Paul III. I have raised his son, and I know Paul Clifton personally and had a lot of relationship through me and his son and the accident that we for years.
Yeah. And who are the other two victims?
Recently, it was Toya Frazier, grandmother and mother, and who was going through heroin withdrawal, and she died. She was complaining to the guards for hours and half a day, screaming in her cell that her stomach hurt, and the guards, according to witnesses that were also locked up inside that same facility that she was in, testified that the guards were just laughing at her, and that is now subject of a $1 million lawsuit that the county is facing. And the other person that died was Veronica, and I'm going to forget her last name. Her nickname is Love.
Love. What's Veronica? She used to be a baker. I grew up. She grew up in my neighborhood.
Yeah.
She got married recently. I can't think of her last name.
But she too was having drug problems.
But with Miss Frazier, here what people should know. She was on a 24-hour watch, and they posted a check on her every 15 minutes. And they got a tape almost up to 90 minutes where no one ever checked on her, never checked on her.
Yeah.
You know, who was the man at the public forum at the Champaign Library that was describing
Charles him? Davidson.
Charles Davidson. My God, you know, I attended that forum, and I was just floored by his story. I mean, it sounded like something from Abu Ghraib, what he had to go through. And in fact, he said if it hadn't been for the fact that the state police or somebody came for him to take him to serve a sentence at Statesville prison, that he would have died if they hadn't have come. If he hadn't have been picked up to go to prison, and then as soon as they took him to prison, they immediately took him to the hospital.
It's tragic that the only place he could get health care was in Statesville prison.
Yeah.
As opposed to our county jail. No, jail is no place to get sick, or have a problem. And that's one thing the sheriff is not being honest with the community about, is that his organization, the law enforcement, is not equipped to handle. And it's just crazy to build this, you know, these kind of services inside the jail at the wrong, very wrong place. Why can't these people be treated out in the community? To be fair to the county, they in light of the criticism of the jail plan, they quickly said, oh, we're going to build a behavioral facility too. And so they have scheduled on their list of shopping spree with the 2% sales tax is a $5 million, they allege a $5 million behavioral and detox facility out in the community. But
I would have to see the plans on that,
right.
Where it's going to be located, how it's going to be staffed. You're not just going to yell it out. and said, this is what we're going to do. Where's the plans at, Chris? Where's the meeting take place?
The problem is that you have law enforcement running those meetings, and the sheriff's department is in charge of those meetings, and obviously it would be not be in their best interest to get a jail built if they were trying to advocate for this behavioral facility. So nobody knows when these meetings are. They're not public.
But the county board is the one to sit president on the sales tax. So this county board ought to be having a meeting where we're going to have this building built and have it where the public can hear it. We can't have these backdoor conversations and then come out and say, oh, we're going to build this facility when the public can't have a chance to even hear what you're planning to do with their money, where you're planning to put it, and how soon you plan. We can have this talk, and we're talking 20 years down the line. So,
yeah.
So, what are they? What time frame are they talking, Chris?
They're not, and they're. I don't think they're serious about the behavioral facility. They're just throwing that in to make it more attractive to vote for the quarter cent sales tax.
Yeah, and of course, you said they're pulling on, liberal bleeding heart, harp strings, if you will, starting to say, oh, we're going to make it humane. I've heard some things about supposedly the reception area now is going to be also, nice and pleasant and friendly, including an ATM machine.
Well, that's right.
Get money to bail out your loved ones.
Because one third of those taken to the county jail stay less than 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to understand that law enforcement in Champaign County spends predominantly most of its time prosecuting and arresting for petty, small crimes, such as driving on a suspended driver's license, ordinance violations, domestic battery, which...
And then with the driver's license, we had last week, was that last week or week before last, the Stone Creek, where they had to come out. And the people.
The expungement?
Yeah, the expungement plan. And a lot of people were coming out there when I was having a conversation to them with the driving stuff. It was just, their fines are so high. You know, I was talking to a guy, he had $12,000 worth of fines.
For what?
Driving.
Yeah. Okay.
$12,000 worth of fine. And we don't even have a living wage in this town. So you're taking poor people and giving them kind of fines, expecting them to try to pay their rent, take care of their family, and take care of this fine that you didn't just, every time they're driving, they're trying to get to work.
Yeah.
And a lot of people I was talking to were still driving out license. They're just trying to get this, where they get some stuff off their record and see if they can get some fines taken down where they can be legal.
Yeah.
Yeah, the fines in Champaign County are extraordinary. Court costs alone are over $300 just to have a case.
Mm-hmm.
And then the fines and the interest on the fines put people way back in a hole. And you can get your driver's license revoked or suspended until you pay these fines off.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then you get your driver's license taken. I talked to two guys, both of them was union people. And they got their driver's license taken for child support.
So, really?
So how can you continuously go to work, which you're a union man, are your jobs across the street around town, or most a lot of your jobs you got to drive a distance to?
That just sounds so counterproductive in all cases here as far as people, how they expect people to pay the fine off if they don't have transportation to work.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, listen, we just about ran out of time. I thought anything both of you'd like to sort of end on as far as any information we need to cover yet, or?
Well, I would say first and foremost, Tuesday, vote no on the county facilities sales tax, and tonight at the Channing Murray Foundation at 6:30, we're going to be showing the documentary The 13th, which is a documentary that explores the 13th Amendment and how it has affected mass incarceration for the last 150
and
years.
And what was the 13th Amendment for listeners who may not know?
Well, 13th Amendment is allegedly the amendment that abolished slavery. It was passed in 1863 during Abraham Lincoln's time, but there was a little loophole thrown in there. Slavery was illegal except if it's a punishment for a crime.
Okay.
And so it has been used to reincarcerate black people for the last 150 years to basically enslave them once again.
To get free labor and cheap labor.
Yes.
Just what slavery is.
Yes.
So,
yeah. And that's a whole topic for another show here, about profiting off the prison industrial complex.
That's 6:30 tonight at the Channing Murray.
Okay.
And vote no on that sales tax.
Okay.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
Okay, thank you, guys. Thank you so much for coming in. You've been listening to Chris Evans and Martell Miller, both local racial justice and community activists here in Champaign-Urbana. And you're listening to the World Labor Hour on radio station WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. And we're going to take a quick music break here, so stay tuned.
Edwards lived in the little town of West Seattle on the other side of Puget Sound. Little tiny house, little bitty kitchen. He was a Norwegian immigrant, gave all of his life to the logging and to the union. He carried his red card in the union every working day of his life. We sat in that little kitchen and he told me the story of the Spokane Free Speech Fight, 1910. I would not attempt to duplicate that rumbling baritone voice or that Norwegian accent, but it's the story the way he told it. He said, "Well, they boomed into Spokane and towns all over the West, looking for work in the silver mines up in the Coeur d'Alenes or in the logging camps or in the wheat harvest, the 110 cats, the great wheatlands that flow away south of Spokane called the Palouse. Well, you jungle up in the flops, wait for the weather to break, and then you go down on the street on Trent Avenue, and there were these rows of little shops called labor sharks. Well, labor sharks hold jobs. You give a labor shark $4, and it entitles you to a job, say putting down a new mine shaft up in the Coeur d'Alenes. Well, you'd boom up there to that job, burning up your road stake as you went. You get up there, work a month, get paid, and then fired. Why? Because the foreman on the job was splitting the labor fees with the shark in town. So crooked as hell, they called it perpetual motion, where you had one job, one worker going to the job, one worker on the job, one worker coming back to buy another damn job. Well, he said that the union, the Wobblies,
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station in Urbana, Illinois. It's Radio Free Urbana, community radio for the people. And just to let you know some public service announcements, first of all, check out the latest issue of In These Times, published in Chicago, Illinois, and available both in print and online nationwide. In this coming week's edition, there's some great articles in here. I can just tell you some of the articles for you to check out. One is the Democrats abandon the white working class to Trump at their own peril. The idea that the working class is a lost cause becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for the Democratic Party. Police are still getting surplus army gear and they're using it to crack down on Standing Rock. The armored vehicles used during mass arrests of water protectors last week likely came from a controversial Defense Department program. And then another article, why we should be very worried about all the neocons flocking to Hillary Clinton. The Republican Party has fallen apart, and the Democrats may end up the preferred party of foreign policy war hawks and neoliberals. And then there's also, these are the ballot measures to pay attention to if you're, you know, a progressive thinking person. This election, there's going to be a lot of various voter referendums on the ballots in a lot of different states, including marijuana legalization, medical marijuana, plastic bag bans, the various minimum wage rates, health care, a big one there out in Colorado as far as getting a Medicare for all single-payer state-based system in Colorado, and also campaign finance. finance and election reform ballot measures. And last but not least, a question as far as another article here. Actually, there's a couple more here. Affordable housing is vanishing, and these some more ballot initiatives in various states could help stem the crisis. Also, Southern California's SEIU, Service Employees International Union, caucuses call on the AFL-CIO to kick out the police union from the national AFL-CIO. And lastly, how the Trans-Pacific Partnership would fail to help struggling farmers. You can check those out in the magazine in these times. There's four events that are happening just today here in Champaign-Urbana. There's from 2 to 4 p.m. on the corner of Main and Neal Street in downtown Champaign is the monthly anti-war and racism anti-war demonstration. Then 4 to 5:30 p.m. today at McKinley Foundation, 809 South 5th Street in Champaign, anti-war activist Medea Benjamin of Code Pink speaks on her book tour about her new book, The Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the U.S.-Saudi Arabia Connection. And at 6:30 at Chenny Murray Foundation is a showing and discussion of the film The 13th, a documentary on mass incarceration in America and its roots in slavery, a film by Ava DuVernay, who also made Selma, the film Selma. Local activist James Kilgore, who is interviewed in the film, will lead a discussion following the film showing. And last but not least, the benefit concert for Standing Rock Struggle here in Champaign-Urbana, See You for Standing Rock, will be here at the Independent Media Center / Downtown Urbana Post Office Building, 202 South Broadway in Urbana, today, starting at 1 p.m. and going to 10 p.m. tonight. And this fundraiser event will consist of a mix of live music from local bands interspersed with presentations from Native American speakers about the current situation in the Dakota Access Pipeline, Native American culture, heritage, and history. And they let you know that there will be non-alcoholic drinks served, such as juice, soda, a bottle of water, and they'll be available from the cafeteria nearby, as well as food trucks outside if you would like any food. And that's today from starting at 1 o'clock going until 10. So come on and help support the Standing Rock occupation, and let you know that here on WRFU after the Union Edge starting at 2 p.m. is now their sports show from 2 to 3 with fellow worker Neil Parthen. And on Sunday on Urbana Public Television is Labor's World View TV from 4 to 5 p.m. And that's at Comcast Channel 6 and Urbana Public Television .org. And it's this week's on Sunday's presentation is a little segment called A More Effective Evil, which is basically a discussion from Bush Dixon of the Black Agenda Report. And also on Sunday here at WRFU from 6 to 8 is the People's History Hour, all of us on WRFU. And you're listening again to the World Labor Hour on WRFU Radio Free Urbana, broadcasting from downtown Urbana, Illinois. So I have Angela Bingham in here with me as a co-host today. Unfortunately, Gus Wood is out sick today, and Bill Gorell said he would be joining us here about this time. So if you're listening, Bill, come on down. I would love to have you. But anyway, Angela, so what are your thoughts about Chris and Martel's talk about this quarter cent sales tax referendum?
Well, first off, I would agree with him that everybody vote no for that quarter cent tax. And I agree that everything that they're saying is true, and I also believe that it's all about money. You know, the county makes so much money off of inmates. They're making money off prisoners. This is how they're getting rich, and they want to build more and more to incarcerate more people. How much money does it take?
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, this is called the prison industrial complex. I mean, and this is just on the county level, you know, not to mention, you know, the large state and also federal prisons out there, both that are administered by the, owned by the state of whatever state and federal government. There's also these private corporate prisons out there. And, you know, one thing is mentioned, is about this whole thing with profiting off of these prisoners' labor.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? Love and Toya, oh, both of those were good friends of mine.
Oh, really? You know
them
too?
I've been knowing them forever. And, you know, I mean, like they were discussing earlier, they don't need to be in jail for help. You know what? They need to be trying to build more places for them to go and get help, you know. Jail is not the place for them to be. And then, like I said, you know, my son was incarcerated here. Mm-hmm. He had a toothache, And luckily I had minutes on the phone, so he was able to call me and tell me, Mom, they're ignoring me like, you know, they done other people in the past. But I would call up there, you know, I would keep calling because my son isn't just complaining for no reason. You still have to check on these people because, you know, or otherwise, you know, they could die. Just like my two friends that died. But, you know, it's just not fair, and we're still in slavery. That's the poorest thing.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've heard, of course, we have a mutual friend. I won't mention his name on the air. He promised he'd come on the show sometime, mm-hmm. though. But he was talking about his time in federal prison, about how he sewed garments for the U.S. military and stuff, and how it was all based on piecework. And, I mean, it was ridiculously low rates. He said that he got really good at it. He was actually able to make close to a dollar and a half an hour. And that's after he got really good at it, you know.
Wow.
I mean, that's ridiculous. And, I mean, you know, granted, traditionally people think of prison labor as like maybe growing gardens for the food for the prison, or
sure.
making license plates, or in this case, you know, sewing garments for the military. But there's so many other, especially the private corporate prisons, and even some of the state and federal ones, where they farm out the prisoners as labor to these huge multinational, or actually, you know, Fortune 500 corporations, you know, everything from, you know, booking airline tickets to sewing garments for Victoria's Secrets, or, you know, all sorts of various, you know, corporate areas that are, I mean, God, you think about it, they can get prisoners, you know, to work for, you know, a dollar an hour or whatever. I mean, that's even cheaper than what they pay workers in Mexico.
Right, but, you know, it's modern day slavery, and you know what, it's just so sad, because you know what, my thing is, from 1860 something, okay, that we were working for free then.
Yeah,
we're still working for free now, but what I'm saying is, how do we get to, what is the minimum wage now?
Well, it's depends on the state, but I think the federal is close to $8 an hour.
Okay, from 1860 something, we've all that time, we've got to $8 an hour.
Yeah.
I believe we should be at, what, about $20, $30 an hour by now.
Well, there's some people say that if the minimum wage would have kept up with inflation, it would have been close to $20 an hour, yeah.
At least by now. I mean, 1860 something, that's a long time, and we're still slaves. And you know what? They keep it at a level where they keep the poor, and the rich keep getting richer.
Yep.
And it's never going to work like that.
Of course not. And the problem is that people don't realize, you know, that the more, I mean, basically the richer and richer wealthy people get, the more all this money they have that they literally almost don't know what to do with it.
Right.
And then what they do is they bribe politicians. And when I say bribe, people say, oh, come on, bribe. Yeah, they're called campaign contributions, mm-hmm. you know. And then we see tons of cases where whenever wealthy individuals or corporations donate to a political candidate, whether it's a Republican or a Democrat, they get something in return. I mean, big time usually. Not to mention the fact that this is part of the reason why we had the 2008 financial meltdown, was that there was all this money out there that these rich people just, you know, didn't know what to do with as far as investments, so they threw it out there in all these derivatives and other types of you know, risky investments that you know, help crash the economy, you know. So, you know, there's several good reasons of why people need to be, there should be a limit on how rich somebody can actually be.
Definitely.
I wouldn't have a problem with it if everybody in society was taken care of, but as you and I both know, that's not the case.
Right, but you know what, there's enough money here for everybody to live comfortably.
There is.
That nobody should be starving, nobody should be without anything, because there's enough money in the United States so that doesn't happen. Well, I mean, we're not like other countries, you know?
Well, some other countries, yeah.
Some, yeah. But there's enough money here where nobody has to starve and go hungry and be without. Kids shouldn't have to go without. You know, it just, like
that's
I said,
true.
It's unfair.
Yeah, that's true. And it's only, it leads to problems. I mean, you know, you think about it, it's like the United States, for an industrialized country, I mean, we have an incredibly high crime rate. I mean, we have crime rates here higher than some lesser developed third world countries.
Yeah,
you know?
Well, you know what? But, you know, I'm going to tell you one of the reasons that is because if they're not going to give it to you, okay, I'm not going to see my son starve, my kids without. Okay, you got to do whatever you have to do. Mm-hmm. To survive in this world, you know, people are like, how are you? I'm like, my head is above water, barely, you know, I'm barely got my head above the water, but we gotta eat.
Yeah.
And we're going to eat by any means necessary.
Well, that's true. And that's just human nature.
It is.
Yeah.
Survival.
But you're absolutely right. There is plenty, you know, you keep hearing this from the politicians constantly, over and over again. There's just no money. There's just no money. But boy, when it comes to a war, they seem to come up with tens of billions of dollars just like that. Snap. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and also, you know, all these tax breaks for the wealthy and these corporations. We had a news story a couple weeks ago talking about that they're estimated there's over almost $2 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars, that are in offshore bank accounts that could be taxed, and basically we could get like tens of billions of dollars on the tax. Well, it looks like Bill Gorrell's joined us in the studio. Hello, Bill.
Hey, Bill.
How you doing, man? You know that old, half paraphrase, Everett Dirksen, throw around a few billion here, a few billion there, and you know, you got a trillion.
Okay. Yep. So, yes. Okay. So, you know, this is the thing is we're just kind of getting a little feedback here from our previous guests, you know, Martell Miller and Chris Evans, that were talking about the jail issue here. And also had a lot of interesting public service announcements, you know, including about that benefit concert for Standing Rock tonight right here at the Independent Media Center. So we're going to take another quick music break here, and you're listening to the World Labor Hour on the supporting community radio station WFT in Champaign, Illinois. We'll be right back.
Eddie, so you found this, huh?
Darling of the energy companies, ripping off what's left of the reservation. I learned a safety rule. I don't know who to thank. Don't stand between the reservation and the corporate bank. They're sending federal tanks. It is a nice.
Well, see what it is. It's class gender bias. Is what it is.
Heart have wounded me. Is it deep in the earth? Won't you cover me with pretty lies? In my heart have wounded me. We got these energy companies who want to take the land. And we got churches by the dozens trying to guide our. For liars, for the fire, and the FBI. They lie in court and get nailed. Still, Leonard Peltier goes off to jail. The bullets don't miss the gun.
Okay, that was the Indigos with Bearing My Heart at Wounded Knee. Thought it'd be an appropriate song, considering we have the benefit for the Standing Rock resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. Man, Bill and Angela, I mean, you wouldn't know it if you're watching the corporate media and stuff, but have you been seeing some of the photos and film footage of what the cops are doing out there to these people?
I haven't seen much video lately. I've read some harrowing reports. In fact, I was just reading one on Facebook today, and it concerned an elder who was captured by the police. And I'm not going to say arrested, I'll say captured mm-hmm. by the police, and is being held captive. And he had some artifact from Peru. A whistle
mm-hmm.
that was a very fine piece of Peruvian, ancient Peruvian art, and only three of these things exist in the world, and the other two are in the Smithsonian Museum.
Mm-hmm.
And that's missing now.
Really?
I imagine the police would have it.
Uh-huh.
They probably don't know what it is.
Well, for sure, but, you know... needless to say, I mean, it very well could have been, well, we won't go into speculation at this point, but it's been known to happen that police steal property from people when they arrest them. That's a very common occurrence and stuff. But I've seen stuff, I mean, you wouldn't believe it looks like, I've seen stuff that reminds me, I thought it was Afghanistan. I mean, these tanks, these, cops and national, you know, out there in military, in like camouflage and helmets and automatic rifles and I mean they got like fire extinguisher sized tear gas canisters, you know, I should say pepper spray and stuff, and these people are in the river, and you know, basically these cops are there trying to shoot them with pepper spray, and of course they're, you know, able to put up blankets, they even got like makeshift shields and stuff, and of course they get doused, they can just, you know, submerge the water, but then the cops got these little floating round things that are motorized where there's like three cops that go up and down the river, and they got these they've been shooting rubber bullets at people. And by the way, I've saw a rubber bullet. Sasha Meinroth went up to the demonstration against the G8 in Quebec, Ontario, quite a few years ago, and he got shot with a rubber bullet, and he brought it back. It is a heavy-duty rubber.
Well, I believe they can
hard. It's actually plastic. It's hard,
sure,
plastic cylinder.
Ribs.
They can break ribs. They can put out an eye. People have been killed by them if they get hit in the temple or other vital areas in the body. So,
by the way, Sasha Meinroth was instrumental in developing this independent media center that we're
That's
at
correct.
Right now.
That's correct. So, you know, when they say get shot with rubber bullets, I mean, it's no picnic, and not to mention the pepper spray. But it's amazing how many people are coming from all over the country joining the resistance out there. And, you know, the cops are basically have banned drones because the Indians were using drones to fly over where the cops were assembled.
Yeah, can you believe
that? Filming their abuses, you know?
That's started happening. I believe it did with Ferguson, where mm-hmm. they declared like a no-fly zone over the community.
Yeah.
You know, that's like bringing the war home.
It is bringing the war home. Absolutely, Bill. I couldn't have said it better. And I'm telling you, you know, it seems like to me that no matter who gets elected, we're in for a rough ride here, one way or another. And in fact, I wanted to read something that somebody sent here to the World Labor Hour email that I thought, was really kind of, on that note here. And I thought it really kind of hit the nail on the head here. He says, but Donald Trump is not a phenomena. He's a representation of a rotten society under the blows of capitalism. Frustration about the economy, a feeling growing of Americans, hopefully the government does not work in interest of the majority of Americans. He goes on to say here that all the feelings that remain are only growing under administration as the economy continues to tank. In fact, so long as I can remember, it's been 8 years of a Democratic presidency, 8 years of war, 8 years of transfer of riches to the wealthiest 1%, 8 years of attacks on social programs and government aid that's pushed many people to fail for his impossible, insincere promise to make America great again. He goes, I won't be voting for Trump and I won't be voting for Clinton, and I do not consider myself as being neutral. We need to fight like heck to end a social and economic system that empowers the right and people like Trump and vote for a Clinton a vote for Clinton is a vote for that system. We have to stop reacting, I believe, and start creating supporting movements that empower the working class and shift the general consciousness. Trump and Clinton both split forward by the parties of Wall Street, the oil and gas companies, the military industrial complex, will both continue war, will both ignore climate change, will both repress people at home and abroad. And he finishes by saying, our best attack against Trump is not supporting Clinton. It's not just voting green or third party, really. It's mass organization, mass protest, defense of water, support for incarcerated strikers, and then some. And those have to happen no matter who is elected.
Yeah, well, Dave, I've been seeing a lot lately. There's been a lot to do with class lately, because a lot of people were are very into this idea that Donald Trump is appealing so much to the working class in the United States. Well, it's not so much that he's perhaps appealing so much to the working class, is that the Democrats haven't been doing anything to appeal to the working class since the 1970s. And somebody who's been bringing that out is Thomas Frank in his new book, Listen Liberal.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other commentators are also talking about this, and that is, in the early 1970s, the Democratic Party, you know, like when the Clintons started getting into it, decided to be the class, I mean, to be the party of the professional class. And so, and I'm thinking right now, liberal elite is actually a true thing. And that's been the biggest problem with the Democratic Party, and it's been the biggest problem for working people, and it's been a really ridiculous thing for unions, because they keep holding on and on and on with this. You know, just like, and it's the same way for us as it is for the anti-abortion people. The Republicans are never going to deliver on that, because once they do, they've lost their issue and they've lost their appeal. I could hear that real well, Dave, over my headphones.
Oh, okay.
All right. So your microphone's working very well, even though your headphones apparently aren't. And that's just what I'm saying. They abandoned the working class. And so the working class doesn't have anything. You know, there was a whole lot of racist union people during the Depression and after the Depression. They could hold that coalition together because the Democrats actually did things for the working class. And then when they made the turn, not only to appealing to just the professionals, but also the turn into, which I think has a lot to do with it, to identity politics at the exclusion of class politics. And that's when they lost their real mass base.
They've been lost, all that. But you know what? This whole election is one big scary horror show.
Oh, that's a great way of describing it, for sure.
Yeah, one big scary horror show.
Yes, indeed. I mean, this is the thing, is that, you know, it's like, they just want to completely, I mean, it's what amazes me. What amazes me is about how there's a lot of people that were very big Bernie Sanders supporters that are just forgetting and forgiving all the stuff that the DNC and Hillary Clinton did to Bernie Sanders' campaign. I mean, you're talking massive election fraud. You're talking about massive voter disenfranchisement in order to get Hillary Clinton elected in the Democratic primaries. All that's forgotten and forgiven. Oh, my God. Here comes Trump. Oh, my God. What about Trump? And this has been their tactic going back. I don't know how far it, and I can't believe people fall for this time after time after time. This whole, you know, lesser evil, oh my God, the world's going to end, you know, if this person or that person's elected instead of this one. And you can't vote for a third. You can't vote your conscience. You can't vote for someone who supports your principles and your values. You've got to vote for this miserable person to prevent an even more miserable person to come, which is really questionable whether or not they're both not in cahoots to begin with.
Yeah, that's, I mean, a lot of people have thought that, but I don't know if Trump would want to go as far as, I mean, man, this stuff with, the sexual assaults and things, you know.
Yeah, that's
kind of, I don't think he would have wanted to do that.
No, and also, you know, I think his ego is a little too big to, you know, work, in tandem, you know.
Yeah, right, for the Clintons, basically.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, no matter what kind of payoff he gets, I mean, he's a billionaire anyway. Granted, he's got some financial irregularities, but, no, that's the only thing that holds me back to think that maybe that's probably not the case. But the bottom line here is that, you know, the American people, we don't have in my opinion, the definition of a democracy is where you have at least one opposition party to the ruling party. And we don't even have that in this country. We don't have an opposition party because both the Democratic and the Republican parties are controlled by corporate money.
Sure. Yeah, they're the same people, and basically, Clinton's just as good as a Romney for them, you know, because for the important things, the economic things, and for the foreign affairs. And I'm hoping she will be more environmentally reasonable than Donald Trump could be, but she'll be sold.
Fracking? Are you kidding? She promoted fracking when she was secretary.
Well, I mean, Obama's all of the above.
Yeah.
You know, when it comes to it. And
she's going
to
continue the same policies, you know.
Yeah, the only hope that we have is that the people who do control them finally realize that, oh, man, we're going to die too.
Yeah. Well, I think the only hope is that people have got to start getting out in the streets and putting huge pressure.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, Ralph Nader wrote a whole book on that.
What was it called?
I can't remember the name of it. I think it was his last book, and it was actually a novel.
Uh-huh.
Where all these billionaires got together and saved the world.
Oh, please.
I can't, you know, it's strange coming from Ralph Nader, but he said.
Okay, well, we should be getting a call here from Scott Summers. My phone was ringing here, my personal cell phone, so I hope, Scott, if you're listening, that's not the number to call in. I gave you the number on the email I sent you last night. So please, if you're listening, call 217-344-2536. That's 217-344-2536. And, you know, I think we're going to take another little music break here. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on Listen to Portage Community Radio Station WFT in Champaign. Here's some more Utah Phillips. And he's going to be singing a song here about an incident that happened about 100 years ago today, November 5th. And I'm going to be talking about that when we come back. So stay tuned.
Oh, Dave, what's happening?
Jack Miller kept the Senior Citizen Center for a long time up there in Seattle, Washington. Jack had spent most of his life in the forest as a logger or timber beast, they called him in those days, because you were treated like an animal. There were no bunk houses. He recalled sleeping on the ground with his fellow workers with their wet clothes in the rainforest piled in a heap next to the fire, hoping that they would be dry by the time to go to work the next day. Spoke many different languages in the forest, and they could hardly talk to each other. It was just like Lawrence. He said most of them had never been to school. Most of them couldn't read or write. Jack Miller could remember the Verona. There was a shingle weaver strike up at Everett, Washington. It was called the Everett Massacre. It's another one of those that didn't make it into the history books. The Wobblies, they chartered a steam launch called the Verona. And they had it sailed up there to Everett, bringing strike relief. And as the boat sailed into the pier, Sheriff McRae had ringed the whole pier with armed deputies. He just deputized every drunk in every bar in town and put a rifle in their hand. Well, they surrounded the boat. And when they lowered the gangplank, Sheriff McRae walked to the end of it and said, "Who are your leaders here?" And they shouted back with one voice, "We are all leaders here." Well, that scared the tar out of the law, you know, and they began shooting. Those deputies began shooting. A lot of those Wobblies were killed. Some of the deputies were killed in the crossfire, though. Arkansas, and the Wobblies, and those that survived made it back to Seattle, they were arrested, and they were thrown in the Snohomish County Jail on a charge of murder. A whole bunch of them. Well, that jail was an all-steel jail. It was the newest affair, all made out of steel. It had just barely opened, so the heat wasn't on, and there was no blankets, and you couldn't get any smokes. So those Wobblies, they passed a note from one cell block to the other. And then by common consent, the next day, they were all gathered in the middle of each cell block. And when the noon whistle blew, they began to jump up and down simultaneously. Up and down, singing all the time. And finally they hit the resonating frequency of that jail and cracked the south wall. They broke the jail. And Jack Miller said, thus proving everlastingly what a union is. A way to get things done together that you can't get done alone. Now Jack said, you know, we didn't have any intellectual life. We lived in our emotions. We were passionate people. And we were comfortable in our emotions. We made commitments to struggle emotionally, commitments for which there are no words. But those commitments carried us through 50, 60 years of struggle. He said, you show me people who make the same commitments intellectually, and I don't know where they'll be next week. Kind of stern, isn't it? Well, he said, armed only with our sense of degradation as human beings, we came together and organized and changed the condition of our lives. Now, this is the hard thing, he said. Why can't you young people, with all you've got, do the same thing?
That was Utah Phillips and Annie DeFranco, and we're back. You're listening to the World Labor, our listener-supported community radio station, WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. And anyway, we're expecting a call here from Scott Summers of the Illinois Green Party, who's a candidate for the U.S. Senate. And I just had a couple news stories I thought I'd run by you here. McDonald's Corporation has agreed to pay $3.75 million to settle a lawsuit claiming it was liable for labor law violations by a California franchise, marking what lawyers said was the first time the company has settled legal claims by a group of U.S. workers at one of its franchises. In a filing in U.S. District Court in San Francisco on Friday, lawyers representing about 800 employees at five restaurants owned by a single franchisee said Illinois-based McDonald's would pay the workers $1.75 million in back pay and damages and $2 million in legal fees. The settlement must be approved by a federal judge comes as McDonald's faced claims before two U.S. agencies that is a joint employer of workers at franchise restaurants, a designation that would make the company liable for legal violations by franchisees and require that it be bargained with workers who unionize. So what do you think? This might open the door here.
Wow.
Because that's always been a barrier, you know, as far as, you know, franchisees are saying that, yes, you know, that's a kind of...
That's the same way with the contractors, too.
Yeah.
Independent contractor stuff.
Yep.
Like with the dispatches on the West Coast for the truckers going to the ports.
Yes. Yes, indeed. And another news story here, I guess Transport Workers Local Union 234 in Philadelphia went out on strike Tuesday, Monday.
Okay. There's the phone.
I think we got a caller calling in. Okay.
Oop.
Okay. I guess it didn't get on there. But try again. For some reason, that call was disconnected. But nevertheless, yes, in Philadelphia, transit workers are planning to go on strike, I guess, here. And it said they failed to reach a deal. Negotiators had worked to close the divide on several issues, including contributions to pension and health insurance. And at midnight, I guess local 234 President Willie Brown released a statement acknowledging that union members would not report for their shifts on Tuesday. And then said they had to picket duty. And I guess this has been going on for months of negotiations over, again, health care. You know, the cost of health care.
Oh, yeah, that's just ridiculous, man. I tell you, I don't get the dental thing.
Mm-hmm.
Why we can't have dental insurance, it's like other insurance. But anyway, speaking of mouths, you eat with mouths, and this story has to do with that. This
okay.
is from KCA-TV in San Antonio, News 4 San Antonio. And anyway, what happened was a San Antonio police officer is fired after bragging to his partner he gave a homeless person a feces sandwich. The department identifies the officer as Matthew Luckhurst, who had been on the force for 5 years. In an exclusive interview, SAPT, I guess that's San Antonio Police Department Chief William McManus, disavowed the officer's alleged behavior. It's a disgrace to the department. It's a disgrace to the badge. It's an attack on dignity, human dignity. Wow, that guy's a cop? The alleged incident happened back in May. The officer's Chief McManus went on to say, the officer's accused of putting feces on bread, putting it in a styrofoam carry-out container, and putting it next to a homeless person. The chief says the officer told his bike patrol partner what he had done, and the partner told him to take back the sandwiches. Quote, so he supposedly walked back or rode back, took the container, and threw it in the trash can. Oh, yeah, like a homeless person wouldn't find it in a trash can, you know.
That's a disgusting story.
The story circulated through the department, triggering an internal affairs investigation in July. Last week, Chief McManus fired Luckhurst. He said it was a practical joke. Said the chief described how Luckhurst characterized what happens. Now, they're saying that it didn't happen, or he just made the story up. There's some people saying this. Now, here's my take on it. You see, this guy, if he would have just murdered a black man,
yeah.
He'd still have his job, and he would have got paid suspension. And where's his union president not out complaining about this firing?
Yes. Hello, WRFU, you're on the air.
Hi, this is Scott Summers checking in. How's everybody doing this morning?
Good, thank you, Scott. Okay, so do you want to let the listeners know, kind of introduce yourself to the listeners, please?
Sure, happy to. My name is Scott Summers, S-U-M-M-E-R-S. And I am the Illinois Green Party candidate for the United States Senate. I'm on your ballot this year. I can tell you a little bit about myself and the Green Party, and perhaps why don't I start with the Green Party.
Okay.
Just overall, generally, if you would like to have more information on the Greens, the website's very easy to remember. It's gp.org. That's gp.org for the National Party. The Illinois Party is ilgp.org. And my campaign website, SummersForSenate.us. So that's my name. It all together is one word, SummersForSenate.us.
Okay, so let me ask you, Scott, what made you decide to run for the U.S. Senate on the Green Party ticket?
Well, I think we all know that our current political system is pretty dysfunctional. I have a lot of ideas and concerns that would not get expressed very well between the two primary parties. And I think it was a very good fit for me philosophically to be joining the Green Party. So all those things came together, and here I am today. I'm very proud to be the party candidate.
Okay, all right, Scott. So basically your two opponents are Republican Mark Kirk and Democrat Tammy Duckworth. What are some of your major differences as far as the issues?
I'd also add in there the Libertarian candidate who's also on the ballot.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry. Yes, okay.
All right. Well, as policy issues, I guess I could start first with Senator Kirk. I'm very concerned about the approach he's been taking to the Illinois state pension problem. He has as much as said to the state of Illinois, go stew in your own juice, which is a heck of a thing for a U.S. senator to say to his own state. Now, certainly, it's an almost intractable problem, but I would hope that the senator would have been much more constructive in his approach than just saying you're on your own. Any senator, I think, has an obligation to his state in that respect. I know that we both, all of us, respect Senator Kirk and respect Representative Duckworth for their personal heroism. They are profiles in courage in terms of overcoming physical disability, and I salute them both. But on a policymaking basis, I think that both of them have a lot to be desired. Neither one appears to have introduced any particularly prominent legislation. Neither of them appears to be on the rungs of leadership. I wouldn't expect them to be at the top of leadership, but they don't even seem to be starting out. So I don't think that they are the type of candidate, from a policy standpoint, not from a personal standpoint, from a policy standpoint, they do not match Illinois' needs at this time.
Okay, and so let me ask you, you've been sort of going, I'm sure you've been knocking on a lot of doors and going to a lot of, public events and stuff. What kind of reception are you getting from a lot of people out in the street or, out at their homes?
A lot of very positive reception, a lot of anxiety. There is, for all that, on the surface of things, it looks like we're having some semblance of an economic recovery. A lot of people still are slipping behind. And they have a lot at stake, a lot of debts they have, and kids to put through college. And that's the whole group of people that I think everybody else is missing, and that's actually the heart of America. And that is the good people of this country who get up every morning and answer the bell and struggle to put food on the table and shoes on the kids. We are leaving them out of this discussion, and that is to everybody's detriment.
Yes, I mean, I don't know if you've, been watching any of the debates between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, but it's just like, if I didn't know better, I'd swear that this was kind of prearranged, because they're not talking about issues that affect regular, ordinary working people and stuff. I mean, it seems like, it's more almost entertainment, and it kind of reminds me almost of that one film with Jim Carrey about the comedian Andy Kaufman, as far as when he had that big brawl and dispute publicly with the wrestler, and supposedly it was all in cahoots, if you will. Not that I'm saying that's what's going on, because frankly I think Donald Trump's ego is much too big to work in concert with anybody, but I guess my main point is it seems like that real issues aren't being talked about during these presidential debates. What do you think?
Well, I agree entirely. I mean, I think almost all of America is appalled by the Trump and Clinton discourse, such as it is. I mean, it almost is a food fight at times. And it's just really it's totally detrimental to our democratic process. I, for one, am appalled.
Yes, and so, I guess, running for the U.S. Senate, I mean, of course, we're, that's an office that's going to have to deal a lot with, not just domestic issues, like health care, police militarization. There's also, you're dealing with a lot of foreign policy issues, of course, is that something that you feel that needs a change?
Foreign policy? Absolutely. We are entirely on the wrong track. And it's largely because we're trying to be the military policeman to the world. And it's obvious, I think, to most people that it's not working very well. All the difficulty in the Middle East, we're still in Afghanistan, any number of smaller conflicts that basically have gone under the radar, particularly in Africa, we're not directly involved, but conflicts all over the world, and we're not peacemakers. That's the whole problem. We need to be good neighbors, and we need to be peacemakers. The solutions to these conflicts will be political. We don't get anywhere by bombing people, strafing people, running drones down on them. It just makes people more angry and makes things worse. Let's give peace a chance, and that's something that is not at all being said in the halls of Congress. Apart from all the fiscal difficulties that these wars are setting us up for. I can certainly go into that as well. I mean, from a bean counting standpoint, we're making colossal mistakes. Forget for the moment, the horrific wars and the injuries and appalling, deaths that are being inflicted. But just from a bean counting standpoint, we're going to be in big trouble.
Yeah, it seems like, when there's talking about money for, whatever, here in the United States, to help human needs, it's like, oh, that's too expensive. Oh, that's going to bankrupt us. But boy, when it comes to a war, they seem to be able to cough up tens, if not hundreds of billion dollars at the stroke of a pen. Where's all that money come from, you think, How'd they find that money all of a sudden? I thought we were broke.
That's right. Well, we're kiting out the national credit card, of course. We've been doing that since the Reagan years, and that's going to be a monumental mistake as well. All this debt, I mean, right now the interest rate on the national debt is very low, as are most commercial loans, of course, at this time. But we get a bit of inflation and we start having the interest rates going up. We are going to have a monumental amount of our tax dollars go to debt service, and that will be strangling even more the human service programs of the country. We really need to rearrange our fiscal priorities.
Well, speaking of which, just made me think of something as far as, what are your views about just how this whole financial system works at the governmental level? In other words, the Federal Reserve. I mean, my understanding is instead of a congressionally controlled central bank, basically this is a system to where the federal government borrows from the banking sector. Is that, do you think that's a good system to have, or do you advocate something different? Or?
I sure do. And it's advocated by a group, you can find them on the website called monetary.org. It's the people's money. It's sovereign money. And basically the bankers control it. They create loans and, in fact, on that basis are creating money. So we as a nation need to take our money supply back. We need banks. We always will, although on a personal basis I prefer credit unions for day-to-day transactions. But we need to assert control over our money. Now, to give it back to Congress would make it too political. I mean, that is part of what prompted the creation of the Federal Reserve in the first place. But that was over 100 years ago, and there's a whole lot of stuff that has happened since that time that nobody would have imagined when the Federal Reserve was set up, and it's time to retool the Federal Reserve.
Okay. And now, basically, you're talking about war abroad. What are your views on the war at home, if you will? Man, I'll tell you, I've been seeing, of course, you don't see much of it on corporate media, but going on the Internet, you're seeing all sorts of horrific photos and video footage images of the resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline. I mean, geez, I mean, all these armed police with, MRAPs and other, I mean, I swear to God, it looked like a scene from Afghanistan. I mean, what are your views in general about this exponential increase in police militarization here in the United States and police killings of unarmed citizens, in particular African Americans and Native Americans?
Well, let's address the pipeline issue.
Sure.
First.
Mm-hmm.
All this militarization stems from a decision a few years back to basically when the Defense Department finds equipment unnecessary or obsolete, they started giving it to local municipalities and state police forces. There was no need for that in the first place. So, in effect, we put military equipment on the streets just by dint of the Pentagon passing it out. I don't really know how that came to pass, but it really has to stop. We are a nation of good, law-abiding people, and to try and intimidate people with what are armaments of war goes way beyond the pale. Let's see. With respect to all the strife, I guess is a polite word, in our streets, a lot of which we've been seeing these past couple of years. I have a feeling that that has been going on for years and years and years, and the only difference at this point is the fact that so many of us carry in our pockets cameras, video cell phones that can record all these things that are happening. That is the big difference. The problem has been lying I won't say lying in the weeds so much, but it's not been raised up as a problem until fairly recently when people with the new technology were able to film these things. We do need to do a whole lot of work as a nation to get these things straightened out. We do need law enforcement, common sense law enforcement, but for everybody to be on a hair trigger sort of a situation, and that goes to way too many guns floating around, I can talk about that as well, But we really need to have our citizenry involved in law enforcement. We need to come to trust our law enforcement. We need to work in collaboration. And the way the cultures are in so many of these law enforcement agencies, it's toxic. That's another polite word, toxic. These killings have to stop. They are utterly appalling.
Yes. So, last but not least, you know, there's a lot of people out there that I've talked to, you know, over the past, I don't know, at least 3 months, that say, gosh, you know, I really love the Green Party. I think their principles are, you know, I agree 100%, but I'm just afraid of voting for the Green Party or another third party, even though I hate, you know, Hillary Clinton and most of the Democratic candidates. How would you respond? Maybe you've been hearing this, too, on your campaigning. How would you respond to that?
Well, I get it all the time, of course. Several things can be said. First of all, let's look at it from a kind of a rear sort of a view. I think as children, even, many of us are raised up and hardwired, actually, to believe in a two-party system. I remember very distinctly my grade school teachers extolling the virtues of our two-party system and how it's the boon of democracy and an example to the world. Well, we all as children and as adults are really kind of socially onto that track, and that's a big mistake. You look at other democracies, the United Kingdom and Canada for two, they've got two major parties in both of those parliaments, but they also have some small parties in there as well. And that freshens the dialogue. That brings new ideas to the fore. And I don't think for a moment that having a few libertarians or greens or socialists or whatever, a few other voices sprinkled into our legislatures across the nation, I don't think for a moment that will bring the republic to its knees. We are right now with a two-party system strangling our democracy.
That was, I thought, very well said. So, Scott, thank you so much for calling in today, and good luck with your campaign. And I'm sure, one way or another, you're probably going to be glad once Wednesday, November 9th comes.
That's for sure. My appreciation to you and all your listeners.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, that was Scott Summers, who's running for the Green Party U.S. Senate, and we're going to take a quick music break here, and we're going to be right back here in a second. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on listener-supported community radio station WRFU in Urbana, Illinois. Stay tuned.
Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten, and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. The mothers and the fathers of those who come riding home in coffins in their military clothes, shiny medals pinned to their dead teenage chests while the trumpets blare, and you lie your best, so ask all you want from the dusk till the dawn. The answer's still no, brother, I'm gone. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. Explain away the sleight of hand and the criminality of spending souls for oil. Well, in the mirror I can see I am the path that leads down. I am the dark and bloody hall. I'm the reaper, executioner, hangman, judge, and the law. So tie a yellow ribbon round the oak tree on the lawn. But the cavalry's not coming. brother, they're gone. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten and the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide. So I'm sharpening my shovel, I'm firing the kiln. I'm blind and I am purposeful, a martyr on the hill. The dream you might be dreaming might be someone else's dream tonight. I'm the whisper of misgivings, I'm the fading tail light. I'm the call for retribution from the back of the smoke-filled hall. I'm the vow of bitterness, I'm the poison in the well. I've a photographic memory of the deeds I will avenge. I'm the cold in the river hollow. I've a hat pin, I've a plan, and I don't care of cause or consequence. Head shaved and body lean, I'm the go-getter, the score settler. I'm the shadow on the green. And there's a flock of blackbirds flying nearly 10,000 strong who set off this morning. Battle hymns for the broken, battle hymns for the misled, battle hymns for the wretched, the forgotten, for the dead. Battle hymns of redemption, of solidarity and pride. Battle hymns we will be singing at the turning of the tide.
Okay, we're back. You're listening to the World Labor Hour on...
This one's for the shoeshine boy and the farmer in debt.
Okay, you're listening. That was Tom Morello got a little carried away there. Actually.
Oh, by the way, Dave, I just looked it up this morning. Tom Morello is now worth...
Oh, wow. I have a voice. Tom Morello is now worth $30 million.
Wow.
He was... Last time I looked it up a couple of years ago, it was $26
million. Okay. All right. So I wanted to talk about something here that... You know, since it's the 5th of November, I just happened to kind of – actually, it was a listener that sent me an email last night when he saw the announcement we sent out for the World Labor Hour, and he said, remember the 5th of November.
Oh.
And I was trying to figure out, is he talking about – where did I hear that before? Oh, yeah, that film V for Vendetta, and that was about Guy Fawkes and the gunpowder plot. But that's not what he meant, because I asked for clarification. What he wanted to prompt me on was the 100th anniversary today of what was called the Everett Massacre. It's also known as Bloody Sunday, and that was an armed confrontation between the IWW and local authorities in Everett, Washington. And anyway, in 1916, Everett, Washington was facing a serious depression. There was ongoing confrontation between business, commercial interests, labor, and labor organizers. And there have been a number of labor-organized rallies and speeches in the street. They were opposed by local law enforcement, which was firmly on the side of business interests. And the industrial workers, the world organizers, had gone to Everett to support a five-month-long strike by shingle workers. Once their vigilantes, organized by business, had beaten them with axe handles and run them out of town, the Seattle IWW decided to go to Everett in numbers to hold a rally and show their support for the striking shingle workers. Does this sound familiar? This is on the Utah Phillips song I played earlier, where he sings it, you know, kind of the history of this. But anyway, as on November 5th, 1916, about 300 IWW members met at the IWW Hall in Seattle, and they marched down the docks where they boarded the steamers the Verona and the Calista, which then headed north to Everett, and the Verona arrived at Everett before Calista, and they approached the dock at early afternoon. The Wobblies sang their fight song, Hold the Fort. Local business interests, knowing the Wobblies were coming, placed armed goon squads in the dock and at least one tugboat in the harbor. And as the previous labor demonstrations, the local businessman has also secured the aid of law enforcement, including the Snohomish County Sheriff Donald McRae, who was known for targeting wobblies for arbitrary arrests and beatings. And anyway, I guess when the boat arrived with the IWW members, the McRae, the sheriff, stepped forward and called out to the IWW member, "Boys, who is your leader?" And the IWW men laughed and jeered, replying, "We're all leaders." And they started to sing out, swing out the gangplank to disembark. And I guess the sheriff drew his pistol, told him he was a sheriff, he was enforcing the law, and they couldn't land there. And there was a silence, and then a wobbly came up to the front and yelled out, "The heck we can't." And just then a single shot ran out, and then over a period of about 10 minutes, intense gunfire exchanged between the IWW members and the local vigilante goon squad. And anyway, I guess over 175 bullets pierced the pilot house of the ship alone. And the captain barely able to avoid being killed by ducking behind the ship's safe. And I guess there was about 12 IWW members killed, and there was also two of the goon squad members were killed. And they brought up on charges, and they tried to charge several of the IWW members with murder. And they went to trial, and I guess everyone, there were 73 of them, all of them were basically found not guilty and released from jail. So that's what happened 100 years ago today, the Everett Massacre.
Wow, yeah, I've read about that. There were so many massacres of IWW people. Was that Frank Little in Centralia?
Oh, yes.
Terrible. That wasn't so much of a massacre as a murder. And that was precipitated by what a lot of people don't realize. A lot of our good Union brothers and sisters are veterans, and they belong to the Foreign Veterans of Foreign Wars and the American Legion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, those organizations were founded after World War One, basically to mess with Union organizers,
now,
especially the IWW out west.
I know that was the case with the American Legion, but I didn't know that was the case with the VFW.
Well, okay, maybe I'm too broad of a brush, but I don't know. I'm thinking maybe both were probably influenced.
Well, for a fact the American Legion. In fact, last year we had that woman on, Esther Goffinet, whose father was actually one of the IWW people who was arrested and ended up serving a long time in prison there in Centralia, Washington, when basically IWW Union Hall was attacked by an armed group of vigilantes on Armistice Day, they used to call Veterans Day. She wrote a whole book on that and everything. And yeah, she, and to this day, Bill, to this day, the American Legion is still trying to promote the original story that they created based on a whole series of lies about what happened. You'd think they wouldn't be concerned about it, it's like they're, and she's gotten into a lot of confrontations. I mean, she wrote a very well documented book with tons of evidence to back up her story about what really happened. And to this day, she has to basically argue publicly against the American Legion that they keep wanting to promote the story that was initially hatched back all the way back in 1916 about the vicious attack on the IWW Union Hall.
Yeah, okay. Well, the only thing that the Wikipedia articles that I just scanned shows is the American Legion, so I apologize to the VFW people, but I still suspect there were other places and other events happened where the VFW was organized in a lot of ways by usually the local capitalists,
mm-hmm.
To oppose, and they would call you a red,
mm-hmm.
and ask you what you did during the war, and such things like that. That's really a sad thing because, these people, they're our brothers and sisters. They should be our fellow workers. And it's really sad that, that their experience in war can be perverted to such an extent to create a patriotism that opposes their brothers and sisters, their comrades, their fellow workers.
Yes, indeed. This is a common thing. It's going on today. I mean, it's amazing. You have to always differentiate between, veterans and, I mean, you can be anti-war and pro, sympathetic to veterans and soldiers even currently serving. Let's face it. I mean, they're basically, most people join the military because they don't have, options here in the, neoliberal U.S. economy. You know, a lot of people join from, you know, inner cities, rural areas, and other places to where they just don't have enough money to go to college and the limited job opportunities.
Well, geez, Dave, look at, I mean, if you, I, surely, of what I read, it's only like about, was it 1 or 3% of the population has been through the military? God, I think it's like about 30% of the building trades.
Well, I was going to say that surprises me. It's only 1 to 3.
Man.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's really, well, there's that organization. I think they call themselves the 3 percenters. They're sort of like that, that one group that's going to watch the elections or something, you know, the Oath Keepers. I think there's another group called the 3 percenters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a similar thing. And, but oh yeah, like in the building trades, you know, just run into veterans all the time.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was because people in the building trades generally don't go to college.
Mm-hmm.
And they, if they weren't somebody who grew up in a building trades family, it's likely it took them a while to figure out what to do and to find the building trades and to finally be able to get into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it's, you know, I mean, I didn't even know there was such a thing as the laborers.
Yeah.
Somebody just told me about going and buying a permit. You know, it was kind of like I dropped out of college myself. You know, I mean, geez, I'm really glad I didn't go to the military.
Yeah.
But that's just, I think that's just what happens with a lot of people. I tell you, too, most people I meet in the building trades, no matter what their trade is, they could have gone to college except for money.
Yep.
Or except for their thinking about it.
Yeah.
You know, now I know it is money, but like when me and Dave were younger, it wasn't that bad. I used to meet a lot of people on jobs who were working summers while they were going to college.
You know, I know in our local Carpenters Union, the age group that was born kind of between 1946 and 1965, basically the baby
boomer. Yeah.
There was, I remember at one point counting of that generation, you know, in the, this is back in, I think, the early 1990s. You know, I counted in our local of, 300 active carpenters working. There was about, I could count just from my own personal experience over a dozen carpenters that had bachelor's degrees.
Yeah. Well, in the 1980s, well, as a matter of fact, one of your favorite old business agents had a degree.
Well, that was, I don't know who you're talking about, and that was questionable, and I can tell you some more stories.
But anyway, yeah, I remember working with a carpenter.
You'd never know it talking to him, of course.
I remember even school teachers.
Mm-hmm.
I remember working with a guy he taught shop in Bloomington, and in summers he'd come back and work as a carpenter.
Yeah, I met a science teacher, actually, a high school science teacher that did the same thing.
But see, with the now there is kind of a problem now, at least with the laborers. I don't know how you might work these things out with the carpenters mm-hmm. now. I do remember a guy I was working with, guy, really one of my favorite laborers, one of my favorite foremen.
Mm-hmm.
And he wanted his son to work summers, you know, and they said, well, we can't do that now because you have to go through the apprenticeship.
Yeah, that didn't exist before, yeah. Well, Bill, you know, I tell you what, we're this is going to be the last show before the national election.
Right, yes.
And so I guess just kind of on an ending note here today, I thought maybe I'd just ask your opinion on what do you think, I don't know, just whatever, what do you think? I mean, what do you think is going to happen, you know, the day after the election, regardless of who's elected to what?
Well, I think what's going to happen the day after the election is that let's say the day after the inauguration.
Oh, you're talking about in January, okay?
Yeah, because you know Obama will still be there doing Obama things.
Yeah, and then also they set the House and Senate newly elected. House
everybody will be lame duck, and it'll be the same thing. So
yeah.
Let's go to we'll fast forward to January. I don't think a whole lot's going to change, even if Donald Trump, because definitely Hillary Clinton is the deep state establishment person here.
Yeah, and they'll make sure she wins one way
right.
or another.
And Donald Trump will have to, will be opposed completely by all elements of the deep state.
Yeah.
As he has been during the election, as a matter of
yes,
fact.
Yes, yes.
So, in one sense, we should be glad that we have the deep state, even though they did kill Kennedy, King, another Kennedy, shot George Wallace, pulled the October surprise on Jimmy Carter,
mm-hmm.
shot Ronald Reagan.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, what else? Did 9/11, man. This is the deep state. It started with Alan Dulles. These people are not elected.
Yeah.
These people are basically self-appointed or they're crony-appointed. They come from private business. The CIA, Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles, they made their bones being Wall Street lawyers screwing over banana republics for the banana companies.
Yes. And the banks, you know.
Right. And that's what, and then they started the CIA.
There's a great book that documents the career of
Devil's Chessboard.
The Devil's Chessboard.
Oh, I have
David Talbot. Oh my gosh. I mean, what a revealing book. And yeah. This guy, I mean, very well documented.
Oh yeah. And what's really strange is that, at least Alan, Dulles.
Yeah.
So it seems sort of a very psychopathic person.
Oh, not only psychopathic, but when he was stationed in Switzerland during World War II and he worked for the OAS, he constantly socialized with Nazis.
Yeah, and he enjoyed sending people to their last meeting or whatever that was going to take them down.
Oh yeah, he was. They only talked a little bit about his brother John Foster, but Alan Dulles. I mean, you talk about a psychopathic fascist that had such a huge impact on America, the course of history of the United States since World War II, which was a horrible change. I mean, because of him and others like him, you know, we could have been the world could have been a whole different place now if it hadn't been for people like him.
Yeah, and that David Talbot, I've heard about half a dozen interviews with him, and he talks about John Foster Dulles, not John Foster, Alan Dulles' son was
wounded in Korea.
And he gave him to the MK Ultra scientists to experiment on.
Yes.
He tried to get his wife to go to one.
Yes.
And his wife knew better, but his son was too messed up. He couldn't protect himself. Yeah, Alan Dulles' daughter, much like Edward Bernays' daughter, Edward Bernays, perhaps the person most responsible for the way things are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, beyond Alan Dulles, Edward Bernays, the father of modern public relations.
And propaganda. Yeah.
His daughter hates him too.
Mm-hmm.
They both, I mean, both, and Donald Trump, I read a thing about Donald Trump today, because I think Donald Trump is close to these people, except he's dumber than they are. He just has their same personality almost.
I disagree, Bill. I think Hillary Clinton's much closer to him. Donald Trump is just an egotistic.
Well, he's a psychopath. And that's what these people are.
So is Hillary Clinton, you know. That's the problem.
But anyway, but what I'm saying is Trump evokes these people more, because I just read a story today, and this guy, there's a guy who was in college with Donald Trump, okay, Junior, or was it Eric? I don't know, one of the sons.
Yeah.
All right, well, he said that Donald came to take this son to a New York Yankees game, and the guy and his son answered the door and was wearing a New York Yankees t-shirt, and Donald slapped him to the ground, and Donald Trump's a big man. Slapped him to the ground and told him to go put a suit on and meet him out at the car.
Yeah.
And he said that this son of Trump's, because of, you know, how he was raised by his dad, was just constantly drunk.
Yeah.
But I mean, in both ways, I mean, this is like the most bizarre. It's like every election it gets worse.
Yes. Yes, indeed.
I mean, I couldn't believe, God, Palin, McCain.
You know, I've gotten some criticism saying that no one's come out and said that they suspect me of being a Trump supporter, but they say, why are you always talking bad about Hillary Clinton? I said, because no one I know personally supports Donald Trump, and I think there's a lot of illusions out there about Hillary Clinton. You know, I know Donald Trump's bad. I mean, he's just despicable. The fact is that you know, he's really legitimizing and bringing out a
now
very fascist element out
there.
Yeah,
he's made it safe to be a racist now.
Yes.
Yeah, and here's something I was watching. I think it was from the Samantha Bee Show.
Mm-hmm.
And what they did was they sent out people to a Trump rally and to ask them about things.
Yeah.
And one of the people was a young black woman. And it was like, and finally one of the last people she talked to, they were like, God, we just don't know what to do. We're afraid to say anything that people will call us racist. You know, and it's just like, I just can't believe it. If you don't want to be called a racist, it just called people African-Americans. Is it that big of a problem? I can understand journalists not liking it because it's a lot longer word than black. Okay? I mean, just be considerate. You don't. That's all I'm saying. You can be racist, but at least just be considerate and hide it. You know, I mean, God.
Well, I don't think racism is good, but you know, that's.
I mean, what is it with these people? Oh, we're so afraid to say anything.
Well, they should, you know. I mean, racism shouldn't be acceptable, for sure.
Yeah, but I mean, they all hang around their own people. It's not like their friends are going to start yelling at them and ostracize them. That's what I don't understand.
Yeah, but see, you know, that's the thing is a lot of people don't know Hillary Clinton, what her real track record. I mean, this woman is, you talk about the deep state. I mean, that's why do you think people like Henry Kissinger, Donald Rumsfeld, I mean, all these people are supporting Hillary Clinton.
Well, and previously Donald Trump.
Previously, yes. Before he decided he wanted to run, I guess his ego was just thought, oh, maybe I should try that. I haven't done that yet.
I got her to come to my wedding.
Yes.
Jesus, man. Right there. That's just the weenie guy he is.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, yeah, I got the permits to build
but
that.
But Hillary
casino.
Clinton is a monster. I mean, I'm not going to cut any words about it. She is a deep state warmonger, a Wall Street puppet. This woman's done so much damage as Secretary of State. I mean, let's do a little biography of Hillary Clinton. First of all, she was a Goldwater Republican when she was in college. Mm-hmm. Okay, then she meets Bill Clinton, and all of a sudden, presto changer, they become Democrats. What was the term they used?
Dave,
new Democrats.
Let me explain something to you, Dave. I was raised in a Republican family.
I know.
When I was a teenager, a very young teenager, I was, 1972. Well, Nixon was the guy.
Yeah.
I thought. No, maybe not 72, but I mean, I'm not bothered with her being a Goldwater girl when she was 15 years old. What I am bothered by is a video that I saw with her, and it showed her like during the first term of the Clinton in Arkansas. She was super feminist hippie, man.
Mm-hmm.
Just long straight hair, no makeup, nothing.
Yeah.
And she was, and they felt that was a big part of him losing the election.
Mm-hmm.
And two things that they picked up was not to be too hippie progressive. That's baloney.
That's baloney. First of all, it is important because she was a Goldwater person when she was in college, okay? That was her college activism.
Then no,
she,
Goldwater
let me finish, Bill.
You
had a chance to talk to
somebody. Goldwater election was 1964.
She was in college at that time.
Not 64.
Yes.
I don't think so.
Yes.
I think she.
No, she was. Look it up. Anyway, it's what she's done.
I don't support her, folks. I mean, that's just.
Yeah, but let me finish.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're partially right, Bill. If that was the only thing, then yeah, that would be something that you could be forgiven and forgotten. But the fact is that they build on this. The Clintons they put forward this progressive image out there when they were running for office in Arkansas and Bill Clinton got elected governor. Robert Shearer, the journalist, says when the Clintons, after they were elected, governor up for, you know, after they'd been in term one office in Arkansas as governor, that they basically cut off aid to the family children. They went after the teachers union, and they were gloating about it, laughing about it.
I know, Dave. What I'm telling you is that that changed them.
No.
Okay, wait.
They were always that way.
No, I don't. No, it doesn't matter if they were always that way or not. It's just like George Wallace, okay? George Wallace lost a race. George Wallace wasn't that bad of a racist. But after that, he lost that race. He said, I'm never going to be out N-worded again.
Mm, mm-hmm.
Okay? And that was losing that governorship of Arkansas was Bill Clinton's N-worded moment. And it's, in fact, the change was astounding if you watched the video
mm-hmm.
with these people. And beyond that, and it literally was late 20 years.
So at best, you're saying they're shameless opportunists.
Yeah, I think they became shameless opportunists, and they still are, and it's like everybody else.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you know, we got only 5 minutes here. I know we're getting a call here.
I'm not defending the Clintons at all.
Okay. Hello, yeah, you're on the air, WRFU.
Jim, I'm checking
in. Yes, Jim, it's going to have to be fast. We got 5 minutes.
All right, fine. I think the Democratic Party is going back to what the old Democratic Party was, the Solid South, the Dixiecrats. It's getting very close to that. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that thing about Jeremy Epstein. who's a billionaire that owns an island in the Virgin Islands.
Oh.
He's a known pedophiliac.
Uh-huh.
And don't you know they call it the Lolita Express. And the Clintons have made many visits to that island. I hope that gets out.
What's the source of this information, Jim?
I'll let you go.
Okay, I'm sorry. I was hoping to get the information, the source of information.
Yeah, Bill Clinton did hang out with that guy, that billionaire Epstein. Guy.
Yeah.
And
he's out for his money.
There's also a woman who is now suing Donald Trump, who says that she was involved in that scene and that Donald Trump raped her when she was 15 years old. Okay, and think about what I'm saying is. I'm not supporting her or anything, but I could see where these things happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe at the time they were opportunists thinking progressive, and then they saw 1980 and this happened. But I think there's points in people's lives where things happen. And as far, except for Bernie Sanders, Sherrod Brown, probably a handful, less than a dozen people on Capitol Hill are just as bad as Bill and Hillary Clinton.
Less than a dozen are?
I would say that.
I'd say 90% of them are just as bad, if not worse, as Hillary and Bill Clinton.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
You made it sound like there was only a dozen, so that we're as bad.
Yeah, but here's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Is if we're just talking about Hillary Clinton being a nasty woman,
who's a liar.
No, not us, me and you. But if the political conversation is only about Hillary Clinton being a nasty liar who killed Vince Foster or whatever.
It's not just that.
And, no, Dave, not between us.
I know.
What it does is it keeps you from talking about policy.
I'm affirming what you're saying,
okay.
Bill.
Didn't sound like it to me.
I was affirming what you were saying. Of course, it's not just about that. It's about what they've done.
I'm sorry.
It's about what they've done over the course of their political
career.
That's
right. And that gets lost in this personality stuff that I get fascinated with. I mean, I am so fascinated with Donald Trump. It about drives me out of my mind.
Seriously?
Every time I see it's everywhere.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just.
Have you been seeing the Saturday Night Lights skits on the
several of them.
I know our mutual friend Carpenter Steve Fargo says, oh my gosh, they are just excellent.
Yes.
He goes, the only thing funnier than the actual debates is the Saturday Night Lights skits, you know.
Well, and also, too, I do have a little bit of a thing for Alec Baldwin, because occasionally Alec Baldwin will say some swear word that people think is inappropriate and get castigated for it.
Oh, dear, yes. So sensitive. Some people are just so sensitive,
but.
Well, okay, I think...
I'm a sensitive person, too. I have feelings.
Yeah,
I have feelings.
We all do, that's the thing, but... some people, I think, just take it to the point of melodrama.
Well, see, I'm a blue-collar man, and I have a loud voice, so you all have to be scared.
Be afraid. Be very afraid. Okay, I guess on that note, you've been listening to the World Labor Hour on Radio Free Urbana, WRFU, broadcast at 104.5 FM and webcasting live at WRFU.net. Come on down to the Independent Media Center, 202 South Broadway, for the benefit concert to support the Dakota Access Pipeline Standing Rock Resistance. That's getting ready to start here in just a few minutes. That's going to go till 10 o'clock tonight. Until next week, be safe and power to the people. Take care.